Mr. Abish, Reel 9. What was the atmosphere in the camp once the liberation had taken place? Were there any reprisals at all?
Well, as soon as the same afternoon, as soon as the British started, you know, after the 1 o'clock coming in, the SS and the others were already gathered by the British. The reprisals came from the prisoners who flushed out anyone they knew who did anything wrong, like capos, vorarbeiters, or anybody who had a grudge against them. And they then all kind of, I witnessed myself various, you know, killings, you know, where they used to hit them in the shin bones with lumps of wood and then take them up from the third floor and throw them down. There must have been, in my estimation, at least 150 killed in the 24 hours. Mostly German capos. Maybe here and there a few other nationalities as well. They were quite cruel. But being in this place was from so many different camps, so everybody had somebody they knew. I mean, in my camp, I wouldn't have known all of them. But so happens, at least a half a dozen of the ardent capos from my original Fürstengruber, I never saw them in Belsen yet. I saw them at the day that they actually murdered them. You know, they actually killed them.
Were these reprisals organized, or were
I remember
they?
One of them shouting, "I did good and I did and that, you know, I helped people and so on," but they still didn't help them because they still. And the amazing thing, who did the killing? It wasn't the Jews, it was the Ukrainians.
Why was that?
I don't know, them seemed to be the only fit ones there.
In that case, why did they kill people who had persecuted the Jews, do you think?
Well, they themselves got a beating, some various things in the camps, whoever those who were in the concentration camps, you know, originally. Because these capos are going back from the time of the early 30s, who were originally were either murderers or all kind of things, who came from the original Dachau and the early days, Buchenwald, who were planted later on into the other concentration camps to be in charge of the others.
I asked before, were the reprisals organized? Were there attempts to have courts and things like this?
Or no, nothing at all. Just flush them out and they got them. The British didn't say anything in the first 24 hours. I think they just... I mean, I didn't see them saying yes or no, but if they allowed to do it, I suppose they did allow it.
Were they present in the camp when it was going on?
I didn't see any British there in the vicinity where the killing was going on, because don't forget there's a huge camp. There were no that so many British soldiers came in inside the camp yet. Although a few tanks came in, you know, and they were speaking on loudspeakers saying that the war is still on and, you know, the fighting is still on. We don't know whether we have to retreat or go forward, but apologize, we haven't got anything yet, you know, food yet or, you know, well, obviously they didn't most probably expect what they found. So they weren't prepared for it.
In that case, how did you manage to keep yourself fed? With no
well,
extra food coming in?
Soon after a day or so, apparently, all kind of magazines were broken into, and they found all kind of tinned food, tinned meat, tinned things, and things like that. And those people who ate them didn't live the next day to survive, because the stomachs couldn't take it in most cases. And people were dying eating those type. I didn't eat those things.
What did you do yourself?
I ate nothing. But after a couple of days, the British wouldn't allow us to go out. So, also, by the way, there were also Jewish, Reverend Hartman, actually, who also came in with the first group of the British, and he also mentioned that, you know, things that they haven't got prepared, but soon help will come and we'll try and organize some food and all this sort of thing. In the meantime, we still didn't have anything. I actually went through the wires underneath and got out. Because my friend now is laying in bed, completely semi-conscious. He couldn't get out of bed. He didn't have the strength. And other people had tried to help. I was a little bit better. Although I couldn't walk upright, really, I managed to go out and get to outside Belsen. There was a Russian prisoner of war camp. They seemed to be quite well off there. And they were handing out, there were lines, you know, queues for soup, like a soup kitchen. So I'm standing in the queue there. And I'm standing next to Ukrainian. The Ukrainian calls the Russian, said, "This is a Jew." You know? So the Russian turned around and said, "We don't know what Jew is. We call Yevrei. Yevrei is a better way of saying Jewish." So anyway, told them to get out of the queue. Wouldn't give us and the soldier, the Russian actually took me by the hand and took me right forward, right in front by the queue, and they gave me the soup first. Right, that's what I remember of that. From there, I walked through the woods. Although people said it was dangerous because the SS were still hiding in the woods, and even Ukrainians were waiting in wait for people that managed to organize to come and went to Bergen to bring food from there. They used to attack them and take away the things they belong. But the main thing from there, as I walked on the main road, is the sensation of, I kept on looking back in front of me, a sensation of walking without guards, or walking, I couldn't make myself believe, you know, that I'm actually free. I'm walking on my own free will. You see, it was a tremendous sensation that I can't really describe it to a full sense what I felt. When I came into the first village in Bergen, I remember it was a farmhouse first. And I went down in this, obviously the Germans have left because of the war was, you know, before the British came. The place was empty, there were a few Russians there, and everybody's going down into the cellar. And I found in the cellar all kind of stored foods, jars of fruits, all kind of anything like it was a preparation for a siege. The first thing I did, I even rings, gold, chain, you know, all kind of things. It didn't bother me about that. I didn't even think of it. The first thing I did is to got myself, I remember, a short sleeve shirt, sort of a striped thing, or sort of like with little squares. I remember that, sort of like a pink and beige sort of thing. And that's what the first thing I took. And there was milk there, you know, because of it was like a farm type of thing. But I didn't, I thought to myself, I mustn't drink milk because that's fat, and I mustn't eat anything, only if I can find something like bread, starch, or made anything from flour to get my stomach back into, you know, to hold the food. Actually, I witnessed something what happened there. Is one of the Russians, apparently there was a woman there, in the area, and then the woman got killed by a Russian. One of the Russians, must have been the Russians from the prisoner of war there outside, and the Red Cap shot him. You know, the British military police, because for killing the German woman. This was just by the way. From there I walked to Bergen itself, and I went in, there was a bakery there, and I got a rucksack from this farm there. With this rucksack, I went to the bakery, and I filled it in with flour and a few other things, and I walked back to the camp, to our camp. Then I started the fire and started making knödels from flour and whatever I could remember I could cook, and then trying to give everybody, especially my friend and some people from my hometown too, trying to get them back into things. And then I went out frequently to organize to bring food in. A few days later, the British were more organized, and they started giving us, I don't know what it looked like, some semolina pudding. You know, it looked, it had sort of an aftertaste, like it would be medicine in it or something. But even that was too rich at first to hold. What happened in the next couple of weeks, that people were still dying in the scores, because even when they got the food, they just couldn't hold it, and everybody was just running around, you know, with dysentery. Then I didn't even know still at that time that there was another Bering Belsen, you know, this place. And then I actually went into that camp where there was typhoid, and there was quite strict even to get into there. I managed to get in there. And there was even worse than in our place. People were laying in bunks, really skeletons. And I was acquiring, of course, anybody from my hometown first. You see, anybody, and naturally I found a few. And they were really, very really bad. And I had food with me, and I gave various people those food, and they remembered me. And I kept on going whenever I could to go and help them.
How did the camp change once the British had taken over?
Well, after a week or so, the British tried already bringing law and order there. There's a lot of things going around there, everybody going everywhere and doing everything, you know. I remember one instance, one of the boys I used to know, running with on his back with a mattress, you know, filled with straw. And the British officer shouting, "Stop!" And they couldn't hear it because he had the mattress over him. And the British officer shot him and landed up a bullet in his arm.
Well, how else did the British change? You've talked about law and order.
They tried to keep you inside the camp. They didn't allow you to go out of the camps.
Why was that?
Well, maybe because for health reasons or anything, epidemics or anything like that. I don't know. But you have to control 80,000 people. It's quite a job, especially when you think you're free.
What epidemics were there in Belsen?
In our particular one, I don't know whether the typhoid was, but the typhoid was in the next camp, you know, where the 50,000 were, where mostly the Jewish people there. And when I was there, I was there in that camp, you know.
Did the roll call still take place?
No, no roll calls. After a while, they tried to identify nationality. Nobody had any papers. I could have said I'm a Dutchman, I'm a Frenchman, or anybody. I mean, I could have said anything, really. But of course, I stuck to my thing that I'm Czech, and that's where I want to go back. So the war ended, right? And on 7th of May, we heard about it, and it was all big celebration, hoorays, and all that sort of thing. That was already, we were released on the 15th, so it was nearly 3 weeks gone by. So lots of things have happened already at that time. You know, we were getting back to, some of us, through our own organization to get back on our feet.
What organizations were these?
Well, like I did organizing food, getting out and bringing in food, because the first week or so we never got anything. And then the British started giving us the semolina pudding. Some of them didn't even want to eat it.
Could you describe what arrangements were made to take you back to Czechoslovakia?
Well, that was too early yet. After the war was over, a week or two later, they started getting organized and getting nationality sorted out, sorting things out. I think the Belgians and the others were taken away fairly early. How they flew me out or what, I don't know, but they left the camps. The Czechs were the ones after that who were gathered. And of course, I'm Jack Brook, and we were taken to Celle by Hanover, which is a town about approximately 30 kilometers from Bergen-Belsen. There we were parked in a big field. Remember, there were stables there. And of course, we went into Celle. We went to the milk places. And the Germans, you couldn't see a lot of young Germans yet, but wherever we saw a bicycle, we used to confiscate it. You couldn't see any grown-up German, you could see women and children. Most of them were still in, you know, hiding. But we went to the shops and so on, and we demanded, right? And we didn't queue or anything, we just went forward and got the food without any money or anything.
What was the reaction of the local population to it?
At first they didn't say anything, there was a resistance later. So we had cheeses and later on and all kind of things. I remember I was staying in a stable, you know, sort of like a two-size stable, and I had a cupboard. Yeah, by the way, I managed to get a complete rucksack. There was some, when I walked in another area, and I got from the French soldiers, I got tins of players and wood, not woodbines, senior service cigarettes. They were in tins of 50s, round tins, and that was like, you know, I didn't smoke myself, but that was like an asset, sort of thing. I got it free from the thing. I remember making a deal with a Polish Jewish boy, who he's supposed to give me a tin meat tins for my cigarette tins, and I couldn't read it very well English or whatever. It turned out they were all beans, so I made a very bad deal. So after that, I learned different. But what mainly we did is to get back with the food. We had all kinds of things organized from the villages and from the towns and so on. We had lots of food now, you know, in the cupboards. And every half an hour is to eat a little bit. This is every half an hour, just a little bit. We were completely free. We had our own fires outside. I was making all kind of, trying to make all kind of things that my mother made or things like that. But of course, it didn't work quite out like that. But the main thing is that every half an hour had to eat a little bit. You couldn't eat a lot. Just eat a little bit in selected food, starchy food rather, right? Still not milk or things like that, because anything that's got fat in it, the stomach wouldn't hold. There were cat and cases where some of the boys went to the farms and caught cows and cut them up. You know, they start killing them and taking off a certain amount of meat and taking it back to the camps. First, the Germans didn't resist, and then they started resisting. One day, a bunch of 20 of the boys got arrested by the Canadians, and they locked them up. You know, then somebody had to go and get them out.
Were you involved in any of these?
Well, the British tried very hard, you know, to make sure that, you know, that that law and order is about.
Were you involved in any of these attempts to take food where there was resistance?
Well, in the early days, they didn't resist. I had a bicycle, took it off from a German boy, say, off, took it, right? The same thing, we went into the shops, we just, you know, demanded.
But later on?
Not by gun, or not by by force, you know, they were just non-resistant. They didn't resist at the time.
What did you do when they did?
Well, they didn't resist in my particular time, but this particular case, as I mentioned, with the 20 boys, the Germans started resisting outside. They were waiting for them outside the village, you know. They were just cutting up the cows on the fields, right, and leaving the rest there, the cow, the, you know, and laying on the ground. So the Germans started resisting. They went to most probably the military, and the military caught them. They imprisoned them. But they were let out. Oh, the first thing they did in Celle is, I remember one Romanian Jew who spoke English. I remember, I called him Ginger. He spoke English, and they started giving us identity cards. You know? And this is a little card about 2 inches high, about 2.5 inches long, that's all. You know, with your name and the nationality, right? This is like a passport.
Who issued you those?
You know, in the offices there, where they had the offices under the British supervision, right? Mostly the Czechs. So we stayed in Celle about, you know, going about freely, going into towns and going there and going there. And of course, I even went back to Belsen a couple of times, to the other camp in Belsen, and I met more women, you know, from my town. And of course, they got a bit more food there from the British already, and I brought in other things, you know. Some were still a week. And, of course, trying to find out whether anybody knows who anybody's been with my sister or so on, you know. Because majority, amazingly, were women. And very few, comparatively, men. Women seem to have survived better than the men did.
Have you any reason to know?
Well, because the women mostly were used from the concentration camp working in the factories, rather than in coal mines or the hard labor or anything like that, and they must probably think. I'll come to it later on, you know, regarding the women camps, you know, when I met already people later on after I got back to Czechoslovakia and Hungary.
How long did you stay in Celle for?
In Celle, so this must have been about till the end of June. And then they gathered us together. You know, it was quite freely. We were quite free there. In Belsen itself, we were, you know, the British were still, you know, very strict not to be able to go out. But in Belsen, we had the free, we could go to towns and so on. We saw a lot of the British soldiers playing cricket, you know, couldn't speak English. We saw them drinking some funny coloured thing which looks, which now we know it's tea with milk, which we never heard of before.
What was the reaction of the British soldiers to you? Did you
very
much
friendly,
contact?
Especially to the boys, you know, very friendly. Sort of couldn't speak, I couldn't speak the English language, and they couldn't speak the German even, most of them. But two people can, believe me, can converse without language. Right? They were very helpful, most of them. And they did a lot of hard work, especially when they got organized. You know, they were really doing all kinds of menial and doing all kinds of jobs.
Such
to help
as?
People to be able to succumb, to survive.
Can you give examples of what they were doing?
Well, I know they were working all hours and doing all kinds of things, you know, to try and save as many people as they could.
How long, when did you leave Celle?
Celle, we were taken by the Canadians, Canadian lorries, with Canadian transport. All through Germany. I remember going through the Russian zone, Magdeburg, Halle, Leipzig, all bombed out all the way through and through the motorways, and they took us all the way to Pilsen, which is in Czechoslovakia already. I remember over the mountains there, coming the borders there, into Pilsen, and in Pilsen there were the Americans there. There were loads and loads of black Americans there, member stations and so on. There's a lot on there. And from there, we stayed overnight. I think it took about a couple of days to transport us. I remember going through, we saw the Russians, tanks and so on. Of course, they were all American equipment, but the Russians, and there was no problem or anything like that. And
we were just, traveling by road or rail?
We were traveling by road in lorries. Lorries with tarpaulins over them. Right, and I don't know how many lorries exactly were. I remember I was with my friend, you know, we were together. We arrived in Pilsen. From Pilsen, they were took some organization already, took us to Prague. We arrived in Prague. As we came into the Vilsonovo Nádraží, this means the main station, and they took us to a sanatorium, my friend and I only, you know, just young boys. Took a sanatorium, and there I met an auntie who worked there as a nurse, although she was in concentration camp herself. There were lots of people already there in the thing. And she said she thinks my sister's alive, and she thinks that my little friend's mother's alive. Where she is, she doesn't know. But she thinks that in Budapest is the main gathering place, where everybody comes there and everybody registers to see who's alive and so on and so on. We were there about 3 days. I managed to remember going out into town. We were allowed to go out into town, and we were in trams and traveling. But the fact that we had short sleeve shirts, people saw our numbers on the arm. But the first thing they do is get up from the seat and make us sit down. So we should sit. Of course, you know, we're embarrassed, but that's what they insisted. I remember going to a cinema and saw the newsreels of Auschwitz, you know, when the Russians came in, you know, and everybody was very worked up, you know, the Czechs about what happened and so on, and of course the story started coming out. Anyway, it was the third day near the Vltava. Vltava is the river running in the middle of, Prague, beautiful city. It's the first time I've actually been in Prague. I was born in Czechoslovakia. But Czechs were very, very friendly. There wasn't a lot of food about in Czechoslovakia. It was rationed, everything. But we got, all the things. They looked after us.
How did they distribute the food to you?
In the sanatorium. It was big like a hospital, you know. I remember being on the second floor. So when we heard that, you know, they wanted us to stay there. So when we heard that it's possible that we want to go to Budapest, since we had this little identity card with us, so we decided to hop it at night, and we went to the station. From there, presented the card, and then we were going along without paying for the train. And then we went to Brno, that's Moravia. There, I remember by the station, there was some kind of office, and they gave us some money and food. Then we went to Bratislava, that's in Slovakia. Again, there was sort of organized already, and we got help. From there, we went to Budapest. So I remember arriving in Budapest in the morning. a friend and I, and there were lots of people waiting on the trains for people to come. So I didn't see anybody yet, I know. So then they took us to a place called Erzsébet Körút, you know, sort of a district of Budapest. And there were some big, sort of like big mansion blocks of flats there, and there were already quite hundreds of people there who came in back earlier, who were, some of them who were already released by the Russians earlier on in January on those places, you know. And somebody said that, recognized me and said that my sister's alive. She's here as well, but she went to look for you. So she went to the station, but we didn't, you know, we must have crossed each other. And as I'm coming out to go out again, to go towards the station, and it's on the white pavement, I was walking along, and there opposite me comes my sister and my future brother-in-law, was with her because my sister was his sister, and they came, that's how they met. And it turns out that he actually was in Dora as well, but he managed to get back earlier. He didn't go to Belsen. He went somewhere else, and he got earlier back to Budapest. So my sister recognized straight away. And of course, then we start talking what happened, you know, about my brother and everything else and so on. So then it was getting carefree, and, you know, we got money from the American Joint. It means American Jewish organization that gave money. And and people registered. So when other people came, they could see who was alive. You know, once you registered, they could trace people for tracing people.
What provision was made before you signed up with the American Joint organization for giving you money?
On the way to Budapest?
That's right, on the way to
well,
Budapest.
Well, the Czechs were very helpful. I mean, hundreds and hundreds of people must probably coming through Czechoslovakia, going various places. So in the stations and so on, there were soups and bread and a bit of money, you know. They produced a little card, identity card, which you got in Belsen, or in Celle, by the way. That sort of carried you on like a little passport.
I see. So when you presented the card and you were given these things.
Given thing because that we are the genuine, patriots from Germany. In Budapest itself, we didn't get a lot of money, but, you know, we got money because we got free food there and we used to go out in Budapest. Budapest itself, you wouldn't have thought the war was on. But in Czechoslovakia, everything was rationed and so on. Here you could go to cafe houses, have the loveliest cakes and the loveliest things and the loveliest food. Theaters were open, cinemas were open. I remember seeing I think it was The Four Feathers, the film, the original thing in Budapest at the time, and it was very sort of opening eyes for him. And, well, there was no shortage of food, but again, we didn't eat a lot. We ate, you know, every hour or every half an hour something, you know, still not, you know, sort of big meals, one go. A lot of goulash soup, of course, in Budapest. After a while, we decided, my sister and I, would go to Rakov, you know, back to our hometown. Here in Hungary, the Russians were traveling inside the trains, and most of the civilians were traveling on top of the train. But also in Budapest, of course, I spoke fluent Hungarian at the time, and I also spoke fluent Russian originally. But I never spoke Hungarian when I went on trams and so on, because I didn't want to pay, because I considered them, they were the original enemies as well. So I was going back, you know, without paying at all, you know, just out of sheer, you know, let's say, have my own back. Anyway, we left Budapest.